Calvert, Real 11.
I repeat, a lot of the, one of the main reasons why the some of the brigades didn't achieve what they might have done after Wingate's death was because they were badly handled by General Intayn, Wingate's successor, who was not in Wingate's mind as regards the Chindit operations. I will now go back to my own affairs just after the retreat from Burma. Wingate sent for me and another one, George Dunlop, who has also been on the retreat from Burma. And we went to Delhi. We were both suffering from malnutrition and malaria and disease. But he said he was forming his brigade. He'd got permission, and he would like us to help. And could I please bring as many people from the Bush Warfare School as possible? And I ought to say here that the training of the brigade, 77th Brigade, was in initial stages carried out by the members of the staff of the Bush Warfare School who volunteered to come along. I was also told that I would have to raise a commando company which members of which would go into each detachment, of which would go into each column of the brigade. He then told us to go off on leave and come back. I went on leave to Bangalore with my sister and met my brother-in-law, who had been in Malaya, and his name was Colonel Hill, and he was in the Rimi, and he had been in the infantry before, so he knew quite a lot about infantry tactics and fighting, and he was evacuated with a number of other experts from Singapore at the last moment as a technician, of which there was a shortage in the British and Indian Army, and they were shipwrecked and then made their way one way or another after a lot of adventures to Sumatra, where they were picked up and taken back to India. During my 6 weeks leave, we talked a lot about the Japanese, and we compared notes on how they fought, and also about the capability of the British and Indian armies to fight, and to fight in the jungle, and their limitations. And we came to the conclusion their main limitations were the officers and the generals, the senior officers and the generals, who wouldn't adapt themselves to a different terrain. Well, then we went down to Saugor, S-A-U-G-O-R, south of Jhansi, J-H-A-N-S-I, and formed camp at a place called Pataria, P-A-T-H-A-R-I-A. There was a Hindu, ruins of a Hindu castle there, and the area itself is stuffed with Indian history from way back, right up to the mutiny where the Rani of Jhansi betrayed the British and had them massacred, and then later on in Retribution Hill, which is a high sandstone peak up to about 1,000 feet high, or possibly not, from 400 or 500 feet high. The British, in retribution, threw the Indian mutineers over the cliff in retribution for the way their wives and children, who'd been left in the hands of the Rani in Jhansi, had been murdered by her. Later, the Indian National Army formed a Rani of Jhansi regiment of women to commemorate the Rani of Jhansi's great deed in the Indian Mutiny. The two battalions were the 13th King's Liverpool Regiment and the 3rd 2nd Gurkhas. The 13th King's had been sent out to India as a garrison battalion. They, on the whole, were elderly, and a lot of them weren't fit. But, however, they had the tenacity and the obstinacy and determination of the Liverpudlian, and in spite of their age, they really did try to learn. They hadn't quite got the offensive spirit which later units had, but they gave Wingett, I think, all the loyalty and devotion of which they were capable. And Wingett did try out ideas on them, on how to march through the jungle, on different, how to make up a column, how to do, go into bivouac form, how to lay ambushes, and so on. And he used them and rehearsed them and rehearsed them again, trying out new methods. And it must have been extremely irksome to them until he had got the matter right. And I ought to say that we take it for granted that we divided the battalions into two columns, and in those columns there were an RAF section, there was the commandos, there was 100 mules, 18 chargers. Later on we had possibly an elephant and some cattle, and we had two lots of signal sets, one RAF and one British. We had a medical team and Burma Rifles, a section of Burma Rifle, a platoon of Burma Rifles. And so it was a cosmopolitan unit, a variegated unit, yet it would march in column through the jungle, and then the column commander would either be near the front or would move up to the front. He would find a suitable place. You couldn't hesitate for long with all these men, 400 men behind you, and he'd choose a place to bivouac, and some of the essentials were, of course, water. It was bamboo to feed the mules. We'd learnt that we could do without forage. The mules would eat bamboo shoots. There was, if possibly, if it could be combined with water, fairly high ground, so our signals sets could carry the 200 miles back to India. We could form a defensive position, and the column commander would march ahead and then stop, and then the rest of the column, you might say the vanguard, would know where to go, and it would advance ahead, and we'd of course gone off the path, and it would take up a defensive position. Then all sections of the column would go as far as the column commander and then branch off to their position in the circle. And the rear guard would continue the march on as deception and would then do as much as they could to cover the where the column had been by brushing the footprints away and so on like that, and would then form an ambush. Within 5 minutes of getting in, each unit would be lighting a fire. Now, we had been trained in this detail by Wingate, who pointed out that very often as we got in, the rains used to come at about 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. He told us to collect up dry sticks from the previous night's bonfire and put them in our pack. So we always had some dry stick kindling wood with us to start a fire. A small point, but an important point. It's possibly a Boy Scout's point, I don't know. Then the wireless set would be up. He'd give the direction of the aerial. The direction of aerials was very important. A lot of the other units in the British and Indian Army didn't understand that. And the length of the aerial was important. Wingate had learnt all that. And then the column commander would sit down. His batman would bring him a hot, sweet cup of tea. And the signals would start receiving messages from India, and the column commander would give the approximate position on the map. I say approximate because sometimes we didn't know quite where we were. It was the first signal to be sent, and that would be a separate signal. So then people knew where we were. Then I must go back to the signals. In the meantime, the muleteers would go off, and there was one muleteer to every two mules, would go off and cut bamboo for their mules and would give them some grain and also take them down to be watered. The men also would go down to fill their water bottles. It was, I forget who did it now, but the stream was divided, so everybody knew which part of the stream they should do these things. The upper bit was for water bottles, the next bit was for mules. The third bit was for washing and possibly washing clothes, and the fourth bit would be for latrines, and wherever possible, it wasn't always done, we would use the running water to defecate into, so that this would be washed away and would not give our position away. We very rarely stayed in a bivouac area for more than overnight, but sometimes we stayed there for 2 or 3 days. The mortars were placed in a position so they could give covering fire, and the Vickers machine guns, which Wingate had taught us to use in the jungle, were put in position too to support the ambush point. The ambush point would be relieved, and the ambush would come in later. And then after an order group, the column commander would give out his orders. The column would settle down to eat and sleep. One thing we did was, whilst the fires were alight, we'd make a second quantity of tea and put this in our water bottles, and then bury the water bottle in leaves or earth just beside in the ground where you slept, and with a few shakapura biscuits, which is a sort of oatmeal biscuit, so that in the morning, which would probably be before light, you could drink some hot or warm sweet tea and eat some shakapura biscuits, and so be ready to march off at short notice. I think I've covered everything in the bivouac, or most of the thing. But all this had been trained by Wingate. None of us knew a thing about it. He had paid attention to details, so everybody knew this. And it really was a really, I don't know how to put this, but it was a most satisfying sight. I won't say it was like ballet or anything else of that nature, but a satisfying sight for a column to make bivouac without any words being spoken, pretty well, and all know their places and settle down. 400 men, 120 animals, all going into their positions without any fuss or trouble, messages going out, water, food, supplies being made, and so on. And also attention being made to defense. And the same in the morning. I would like to start the column just before dawn and get, if possible, 2 hours march in away from our previous bivouac before we settle down to breakfast. We would get those 2 hours, we'd make a good passage, and because we were sometimes going over very, very difficult country, up to 4,000 feet into, or going through streams or through bogs or through dense jungle and so on. But at about 8 or 9 o'clock, we'd halt in column and make our breakfasts and then go on again. Sometimes we'd go into bivouac if it was a dangerous situation. Now, I ought to make one other point about the rations. On the retreat, I had been off and on with Indian units, and I found that due to the administration, let's put it this way, the administration handicapped them in doing their job of patrolling and going about in smaller parties. The reason was the whole battalion was based on company cooking. They used to have a huge iron cooking pot in which the rice for the company was boiled, and it took a hell of a long time. There were no temporary rations, dried rations, whatever you have, for a patrol to go out. So, to a large extent, patrols and all parties were tied to the apron strings of this great company cooker. There were a lot of legends, I should almost call them, what thing, about religious feelings of the Indian or Gurkha, that a white man's shadow shouldn't cast over their food or do anything else of that nature. This was totally, I don't think it worked at all. The Indians weren't in the slightest bit interested in this. And this form of cooking, of course, there was no bullied mutton. There was only bullied beef. And so, again, the Indian army didn't have rations which could be subdivided, so they could go off in small sections or platoons. These were some points which we were faced with when forming the brigade. And on my recommendation to Wingate, I won't say it was mine, because Wingate got blamed for it, I advised him against having Indian units, because mainly from the ration point of view. I remember saying, when I first met some, that the British troops will eat anything, the Gurkhas will eat nearly anything, and the West Africans will eat both. So we concentrated on those three races for our unit. Later on, after the lessons of the retreat, the administration in India got hold of manufactured bully tinned mutton and other things, which made the Indian regiments very much more mobile and being able to split up and so on of that nature. But it should have been done before. The other thing, I couldn't get the Indian Army for some time, or the rations of the Indian Army some time to do, is they gave us 14-pound tins of bully beef. Well, there again, that was hopeless, because, first of all, whoever carried the 14-pound tin of bully beef had to carry less ammunition or something, because what we carried on our backs was up to 70 pounds of stores and 5 days' rations, etc. And then the rest of the platoon had to stick around him to get their ration, 14 pounds. So we insisted on having the ordinary 2-pound tin, or even 1-pound tin, of bully beef. And the Royal Indian Army Service Corps couldn't understand this, but we had to insist on that. Second thing was rice. Now, the Gurkhas, 3rd, 2nd Gurkhas, were now bring me back to the rice problem. First of all, the Indian Army said they could supply no Indian unit for Wingate. Then they said they could only supply a very untrained unit. It was unfortunate that the stories about Wingate, which had been spread by Brocklehurst and Bentinck and others, had an effect on the whole of India Command. And there was this anti-Wingate feeling. But however, definite orders by Wavell put a stop to that. And so they supplied us with the 3rd, 2nd Gurkhas, that's the 3rd Battalion, 2nd Gurkhas, who were only partially trained. Now, to stand up for the Indian Army, the Indian Army had sent their best divisions and their best units to the Middle East. And they were designed, the depots were designed to send reinforcements out to the Middle East. Their second best had gone to Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaya, and Burma. And they had all been lost, or a few came out of Burma. I have read and learnt from Wavell, when the war broke out, under the previous viceroy, they decided that India should not be asked to do too much. And so they gave a limitation of the amount of manpower that India should raise. This was all for the Middle East. And so the Japanese war came as a complete surprise to them, and they weren't ready for it. There was a second thing. At the Indian Mutiny in the 1850s, the sepoys who revolted had also got the Indian gunners to revolt. After the Indian Mutiny, it had decided that all guns should be manned by British gunners. This was carried out through the whole of the period, and except that there were mountain batteries made up of Indians, and I think there are few batteries had been formed before 1939 of Indians. But when India expanded to make proper divisions, they had to form artillery units, they had to form Indian Army Service Corps units to drive trucks, they had to form Indian Army... Hello? They had to form EME units and so on. And of course they asked for volunteers, and a lot of the Indians from depots and things, they saw chances of promotion, especially the more educated ones, and they went off to these units, if not to man them, but to train them. Result is the Indian infantry had been decimated by these demands for their best manpower, and they were they had deteriorated as a result. A lot of this is mentioned in, I think it is Vol. 2 of the history, official history of the war in Burma, after the first Arakan debacle, and I would like to draw the attention of the reader to that, because he'll gain a lot of information, where they go into, they set up a special commission to study the inefficiencies of the Indian Army, because on the first Arakan, two Japanese battalions defeated three Indian Army brigades and put them to flight and out of the Arakan. Churchill had sent a message saying that one out of ten should be shot. And but they came to these conclusions, looked at it all over, and decided there'd always be a Gurkha battalion in each brigade,